Welcome to One Health Wednesdays. This podcast aims to promote the principles of One Health and encourage professional development. Here's your host, Ginger Dixon.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to One Health Wednesdays, a collaboration between LabOp Global and One Life Epi Solutions. I'm Ginger Dixon, and I'd like to introduce our guest today, Daniel Williamson. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. For those of you who don't know, Daniel is a colleague that I've had the pleasure of working with and know how amazing he is. So he is an infectious disease epidemiologist and medical entomologist. And Daniel, we'd love to know more about, you know, your background and the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently in the final semester of my PhD at the University of Arizona. And I also own and operate the business Arbo Scientific. And we're a business that surveillance and viral testing for organisms, the means to collect it themselves. And we're also developing new products, technologies, and services that make vector surveillance more obtainable for those organizations and also reduce the burden that some of the current surveillance equipment requires.
That's excellent. So how did you get into your PhD work and then starting Arbo Scientific?
Yeah, we were kind of talking about this just a little bit ago, but we're kindred spirits. When I was a kid, I was fascinated with the idea of infectious disease. Well, that and dinosaurs, of course. but I suppose it really started with the book The Hot Zone and the movie Outbreak. It really got me into wanting the thrill of working in a biosafety level 4 lab with hot agents like Ebola or like hantavirus.
Absolutely.
But as I got older, my interest shifted a little bit and I took a different path. I actually went into law enforcement for a few years, and it was a good experience, but I decided not to pursue that. And in 2008, I moved from Illinois to Arizona and decided to take some classes at a community college. I knew I wanted to do something in the biology realm. And so I took a lot of classes from all sorts of different disciplines, classes like animal behavior, chemistry. I took marine biology, ecology, and microbiology. And during the microbiology course, it really made me fall in love again with the idea of infectious pathogens. And I decided to pursue that. And so I finished my bachelor's in microbiology at Arizona State University.
That's very cool. And I saw, so pulling from your LinkedIn, it looks like you were part of a group called Micro Devils, which is a really cool group name. Tell us more about that.
the Micro Devils? Was basically just microbiology students getting together and playing board games like Settlers of Catan. It was nothing official. Sometimes we would look through microscopes at things, but it was a very casual club for the most part.
That's very cool. We're huge advocates for game-based learning here, so.
So after I finished that, I knew I wanted to continue my education along the same path, but I wasn't quite sure what direction I wanted to go with micro. I was drawn to the different aspects like virology, epidemiology, even like bioterrorism. I believe it's Oklahoma University had a really interesting bioterrorism program. And I was considering that, and I was starting to look at other schools around the country and their faculty and the projects they were all working on. And I stumbled upon Dr. Casey Ernst at the University of Arizona and the work she was doing with mosquito transmitted disease, mostly in Southern Arizona and in Sonora, Mexico.
Yeah.
And I sent her some emails about her research and didn't really have a whole lot of communication with her, but I decided to pull the trigger and go ahead and apply and go to the U of A for an MPH in infectious disease epidemiology. And once I got in, I basically barraged Casey with emails until she finally gave me a, a volunteer position helping out with some field work. And after a while, that eventually led me into a staff position, and I completed my MPH with her, mostly looking at the Aedes aegypti mosquito, its disease transmission characteristics, and habitat preferences in Mexico and Southern Arizona.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And from my experience with Dr. Ernst, she is absolutely fantastic, but yes, hard to get a hold of. So
yeah, she's always somewhere, usually out of the continent. Very, very busy. Yeah.
Well, very cool. So your work and your MPH was on the Aedes aegypti, and then now in your PhD work, you're also working with mosquito vectors as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's pretty much the same team from my master's. So really lucky to have this team that they kind of go in for the same together on the same grants. And so we have a couple ecologists, epidemiologists, a PCR guru. It's just lots of basically different individuals that bring something to the table that can make these big projects work pretty seamlessly. And so I was, after finishing my master's, I was pretty much ushered in by that same team into a PhD in entomology. The project grant that we got approved, and I wanted to be a part of it. So I joined the PhD program, and we went from there. My PhD research focuses on vector ecology and control efficacy, specifically how species interact with the space in which we live, as well as how they interact with us, and then what the solutions are that we have to combat them and how well those solutions work.
That's excellent. And very One Health, which is part of why I was so excited to bring you on. You know, that mosquitoes and vector-borne disease are one of those where there's so much involved with the environment and with human factors. And so it's very much a One Health exercise of looking at all those different pieces and ecology and what's going on. And so definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think you had mentioned, so we talk a lot about AMR in this One Health space, and you had mentioned that you had had some interesting findings about resistance in your mosquito research. If you'd like to share any of those, or, you know, if anything's proprietary or private, I actually don't want to encroach on that.
No problem. Resistance. So I guess I should start with how the resistance is starting so most of my research is conducted in Maricopa County, and
in Arizona.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in Arizona. And so yeah, I'm happy to go over the character, the specifics of my research, but to begin with, I'll just go over a brief overview of how mosquito-borne disease works to give everyone a bit of a background.
Yes.
So only the female mosquitoes bite us, and they do this because they need a blood meal in order to properly develop a clutch of eggs. Male mosquitoes do feed, but primarily on nectar. So they do contribute to pollinization a little bit, but not to the extent that we wouldn't be able to survive without them, like bees or other pollinators.
I did not know that part.
Yeah. And some of the mosquitoes that we catch, even the females just prefer to feed on pollen, which is interesting, or nectar. And a lot of those mosquitoes are actually pretty large, which is good that they're not biting, because those would be painful. But
right.
but as for disease transmission, for this example, we'll use the mosquito Aedes aegypti. When a female mosquito takes a blood meal from a person, say that person is infected with the dengue virus, she'll take up the virus into her gut. So as for disease transmission, you can use the mosquito Aedes aegypti for an example. And when the female mosquito takes a blood meal from a person, if that person is infected with dengue virus, she'll uptake the virus into her gut. And over a period of time, that depends on several factors, like temperature, what disease it is, lots of different factors. It'll be roughly about a week or less. The virus will move from the mosquito's midgut and disseminate throughout the rest of its body and make its way to the salivary glands. And while that's happening, the mosquito's already developed a clutch of eggs and has laid them. And now she's going to start that process all over again. And when it's time to take another blood meal to develop her next clutch of eggs, she's now infectious with the dengue virus that's residing in her salivary glands. And whomever she bites will become infected with dengue. So it is important to note that not all species of mosquitoes can transmit every virus. Viruses are usually pretty specific to species, sometimes genus specific. And what's more, not all infected hosts can transmit a virus to a mosquito. So even if you have the correct vector for a virus, the viral load in that host might not be enough to infect the mosquito. West Nile virus, for example, is transmitted primarily from mosquito to bird to mosquito in an enzootic cycle. Humans and horses are able to be infected, but we're dead-end hosts. So West Nile virus, even if we had West Nile, a mosquito that landed on us and bit it couldn't take the virus from us. They have to get it from a bird.
Yeah, so it's kind of this matching game of, you know, right host, right virus, right mosquito, for there to be this transmission dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And you've done an excellent job of explaining this, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. And then so that kind of leads in, West Nile actually leads into what I'm looking at for my research specifically. So I'm looking at the mosquitoes responsible for West Nile virus transmission. And those are also the same mosquitoes that can spread St. Louis encephalitis here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. A little background on West Nile. West Nile entered Arizona in 2003. And for the most part, we tend to hover around an average of 100 cases a year with plus or minus 7 deaths. However, last year in 2021, we had the worst year in the history of West Nile virus in the United States. The state of Arizona did. We had just shy of 1,700 cases. Wow. And 110 deaths. And because of 2021, it nearly doubled our average over the past 20 years. So it's a very, very serious problem. And we're actually still looking into what the potential causes of that spike are. There's lots of small factors that can kind of compound on each other to make a situation like that possible.
Yeah. And then just kind of preliminary speculating, what factors do you feel like might have influenced some of that to have such a huge spike?
So as I said, those mosquitoes are going to be feeding off birds. So we need to look at where the birds and the mosquitoes are at the same time. So mm-hmm. We also, in 2020, we had one of the driest years that we had on record. And 2021 was a record year for rain. So we had a very dry year followed by a very wet year. And one of the reasons that we think may have contributed to such a high number of cases is that during that dry year, the birds all came together looking for water sources. and the mosquitoes came with them. So you have a very concentrated area with birds and mosquitoes transmitting virus and just ramping up viral carriers. And as soon as those rains came the following year, everything dispersed and everything grew exponentially. So that could be one of the main reasons that we're seeing, that we saw that big spike. There's lots of other small things that could have contributed as well. And like I said, we don't really understand everything.
Well, that's a pretty brilliant, I guess, guess. Yeah. You know, some really good reasoning about, you know, why we might have seen that spike. And it's interesting to think of. So we know with projected, you know, changing climate in the future that we might see more of those extremes, you know, from one year to the next. And so that's an interesting implication of that to look forward to in the future, is if that was what was going on, you know, can we expect more of these spikes with those, that fluctuating weather patterns in the future?
Absolutely. There's also, I mean, we were still pretty heavily in the pandemic at the time. A lot of people were at home more often. They were working remotely, doing a lot more outdoor activities around the house. So there could have been an increased exposure. A lot more people were migrating to Arizona at the time. So I don't know for sure if this is entirely possible or how likely this could be, but if someone is moving from an area that has West Nile and they've been exposed to it, they may not have the same antibodies or resistance to a different strain of West Nile, say the strain that is native to us. So that's something that we've talked about at the U of A, and we wanted to look at different strains and the immunity between the two between many different strains. So lots of different things, like I said, that could have impacted, especially, I mean, the more rain you have, the more areas that mosquitoes can lay their eggs and grow their immature larvae. So
yeah, and I'm glad to see that there is, you know, research on that going on, and definitely even more highlighting the need for, you know, these interdisciplinary teams of people working together, where you have, you know, the virologist and epidemiologist and ecologist and medical entomologist, which you cover at least two of those hats. So but yeah, that's I'm glad to see that that's going on. It's definitely important.
Yeah. And in terms of Arizona specifically, we have two primary vectors of West Nile virus, Culex tarsalis mosquito and Culex quincafasciatus. You'll see them everywhere. They live around us. They interact with us. But the interesting thing is they actually have two different types of areas they prefer to complete their life cycle in. As I just said, mosquito immature phase is completely aquatic. So they need a standing water source in order to develop into an adult. When they are in their immature phase, they feed on microorganisms within the water. And once they become large enough, they pupate into a type of hardened casing, kind of like a cocoon, that the adult mosquito will develop in. And once the mosquito's developed, the adult will emerge out onto the water surface, gain its strength a little bit, and then it'll take flight and it'll start looking for a mate and looking for a host. The differences in where these mosquitoes prefer to complete their life cycle, quincafasciatus mosquitoes really seem to thrive in urban environments, and they'll use small fish ponds, man-made water holding containers like buckets and tires. They'll also use public drainage features like dry wells or street drains to lay their eggs. And tarsalis prefer more agricultural areas, larger bodies of water. But we do sometimes see overlap in habitat between the two species. So it's also, the desert Southwest is very unique. And our mosquitoes behave a little bit differently than in other parts of the country. And we've seen this variation between studies. So you'll find in California, their tarsalis mosquitoes really like rice fields. And of course we don't have those here, but we do a lot of flood irrigation. And so they'll utilize that here. So you really have to look at the individual niche, even though our individual niche is a very large space. Our mosquitoes do behave quite a bit differently than mosquitoes in other parts of the country.
Yeah. And it's great to recognize that, especially in the work that you're doing with Arvo Scientific, you know, trying to do mosquito surveillance in different areas and having that good understanding of how the landscapes and human interactions, as well as the species preference, all kind of interact to really find where they are and where transmission might be occurring.
Yeah. And that's actually, so that's one part of my dissertation, is we're actually looking at land use in Maricopa County, where Phoenix resides, and how that could correlate with the species caught in surveillance traps that were within that area. So by looking for patterns where particular species may prefer a certain type of land use, this is information we can use during times of disease outbreaks or preparing for intervention strategies. If we know a certain species likes a specific type of land use, then we can focus attention on those areas with that designation. So if we know that you're catching 60% of your tarsalis mosquitoes in an area that's designated as an agricultural spot, that would be a pretty good indicator of, hey, we should focus our efforts on these agricultural spots if we want to control the tarsalis.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially with limited resources and trying to really do this outbreak prevention, you know, rather than tracking it down after the fact, like we saw with COVID. And so that's great to have a better idea of where to really hone in on.
Yeah. And once we do know where they're at, then we can start controlling them. And the second part of my dissertation is actually looking at adulticide spraying, or targeting the adult form of the mosquito, primarily through the use of ultra low volume sprayers that are truck mounted. So they'll drive through neighborhoods or whatever areas that are impacted in fog. And for that adult control, if mosquitoes are extra abundant, or if a mosquito in a surveillance area tests positive for a virus, those are usually the indicators or the triggers that will cause those spray events. And that's only if in areas that have the ability to control mosquitoes like that. Not all counties in Arizona, or cities for that matter, have that option. They don't have the funding for control or the accessibility for control. So I'm looking primarily, again, most of my research is conducted in Phoenix, and I'm looking at the efficacy of those spray events on density of mosquitoes before the spray event versus the density after, to see if those spray events are actually working.
Yeah, which is excellent research as well, to, you know, make sure if we're spending all this time and money to control the mosquitoes, is this working, you know? And do you see any challenges with the adulticide, that the insecticide that they're using? Have you observed any issues or resistance or anything like that?
Absolutely. Maricopa has been using the insecticide class of pyrethroids for over a decade, probably almost two decades. And the mosquitoes up there are very, very resistant to pyrethroids. We're doing that, we're checking that through CDC bottle bioassays. And That's not to say that the insecticides aren't effective anymore over long periods of time, but they aren't as effective as they should be. And the nice thing about pyrethroids is that they're very low toxicity to mammals. So you don't have to, there's not as much red tape in order to have or gain access to use them. And you don't have to worry about exposure to people as much. The other primary insecticide that's being used in other parts of the world and country are organophosphates. And those have a much higher toxicity in mammals. And it's harder to get approval to use them, and they need to be used with much greater care. Resistance to these insecticides, so the nice thing about both pyrethroids and organophosphates is they can be used in a complementary way, because they both target different areas or they both have different methods of killing the mosquitoes. Pyrethroids target the voltage-gated sodium channel in the neuron membrane, and what they do is they prolong its open state, and so that causes the neuron to continually fire, which causes spasming, muscle spasms, and eventually death in the insects. Organophosphates inhibit acetylcholinesterase activity, and that will create an accumulation of acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter. And this all occurs in the synapse of the neuromuscular junctions. And when that buildup, with that buildup, it causes the continuous firing of the nerve impulses, which again overload the nervous system, causes spasming, and will eventually kill the insect. When mosquitoes develop resistance to these, they develop mutations associated with these modes of action. For example, OP resistance is going to be attributed to the overproduction of two different esterases, and they will bind to the organophosphate that's inhibiting that acetylcholinesterase activity. And once they're bound, the esterase can remove the organophosphate, and that reactivates acetylcholinesterase's ability to cleave acetylcholine. So that resistance basically makes the organophosphate useless. Resistance comes at a fitness cost. So mutations usually come with a much longer developmental time. Some mosquitoes will have reduced wing length, so they can't travel as far or as easily. They have shorter lifespans. It impacts their reproductive rates. In short, survival requires a very high fitness cost if they're exposed to these insecticides. So constant insecticide pressure will create major mutations, and you'll have resistance colonies. But if you're cycling between these two insecticides, and they have different modes of actions, you can actually, not only can you reduce resistance buildup, but you can keep those reduced fitness costs of the, in the insects. And you can keep the reduced fitness costs in the insects and eliminate the benefit of resistance. So you can, if you treat with pyrethroids and they start to develop resistance to pyrethroids and they have a negative fitness cost, then you start treating with organophosphates. So they're already at a disadvantage because they have all these fitness costs associated with pyrethroids, and then you come in with a brand new insecticide and you just smash them.
Right.
And then when they start developing those fitness costs and resistance to OPs, you go back to pyrethroids. So it's really important to rotate your insecticides to keep the populations down, and to keep them from adapting.
Okay. And, you know, I have to tell you, you really brought your A game today with biology and physiology and chemistry. And
this is what I've In the final semester of your dissertation, this is all that I'm doing is just reading and writing, and so it's all fresh. I'm sure it'll all be gone by the spring. So.
I understand completely, but I really appreciate you sharing. And apparently we have the timing perfect too, because it's really interesting to hear all this, at this expert level. And so, very cool, very interesting stuff that you're working on.
Thanks. Yeah, it's I enjoy it, and it's really meaningful to the good of public health. If we can get ahead of the mosquitoes, and like you said, climate change is just driving things for the worst. We're seeing viruses push their way into new ranges. Mosquitoes pushing into new ranges, and we're exposing populations to things they've never been exposed to. So the faster we can get ahead of it, the better everybody's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we appreciate the work that you're doing, both with your research and with Arbo Scientific, and really advocating for this research and surveillance so we can get ahead of the curve, with these changes. So thank you. Yeah. And we want to ask you at this point, do you have any advice for people who are, earlier in their careers, or people who are students, or maybe want to transition into a different field or get into medical entomology?
I really kind of I see education progression almost as a funnel. So when you first start out, you're going to be bombarded with everything, a little bit of everything. And then as you continually move, whether you move into a master's program or straight into a PhD program, that funnel is going to narrow. You're going to really find out what your niche is, what you want to do. And then you're going to start making contacts, and you're going to start branching out and meeting people at conferences, and it'll really give you an idea of what you want to do at that point. So start talking to people in the field, find out what their projects are that they're working on. If that interests you, reach out to them, see if there's a program that you could work on under them on. And if there is, and they're not talking to you, just send them 1,000 emails. That worked for me.
Yeah, it does work, folks. It
They'll
does work. Just put on a 2-week follow-up schedule and
give you a volunteer position just to shut you up.
yep.
And if Casey listens to this, I'm sorry, Casey, but
Right.
I
Right.
had to do it.
No, that really is great advice. And I think that the underlying message of persistence, go for what you want and the people who are doing the type of work that you're interested in. So it's a good message. It's a good message.
But and I mean, yes, I did kind of concentrate myself into vector-borne disease. I do a little bit of tick work, but primarily mosquitoes. But I do still have the drive or the desire to work in a biosafety level four sometime. I haven't lost that from my childhood. It could
Yeah.
be very exciting. But also very nerve-wracking, I guess.
Yeah. We were talking about if you get the opportunity to go out to Walter Reed and work up there with Ebola and
Yeah, it would be a very interesting experience. It would fulfill one of my childhood aspirations, but I actually got to fill my other childhood aspirations. I told you I loved dinosaurs. Back, it's been probably, oh shoot, 15 years now. I actually discovered a new dinosaur species.
What?
Yeah, it
Okay, tell
was.
us more.
I went on an a paleontology dig with a couple people that I met and in New Mexico. And I was wandering around out in the desert with my dog, and I looked up on this hillside where that she was running across, and there was a partial skeleton sticking out of this formation. And went up there and marked the location and went back and got everybody. And I'm there with like PhD candidates from all over the place, University of Utah and out east, people that are like, all they want to do is find a dinosaur. And here I am, a microbiologist out here just helping out. And I find this new species. And it turns out they named it Invicterix zephyri. And it was it's a nodosaur. So if you know what an ankylosaurus looks like, a big armored dinosaur, it's that type of dinosaur. And so we found it in the spring. And then they went back out in the fall and they found another specimen. And then a few years later found another one. So it was really, really interesting. It was a new species found. But I just thought it was so funny that I found the first one. So I got credited with the find. I have my own Wikipedia page and everything on it. It's really cool.
That is really cool.
It's a bucket list item.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to share your Wikipedia link for that too, so our audience can go check out this dinosaur. And did you get to help name it since you found it?
No, I didn't. I kind of lost contact with them, and I'm really happy with what they named it though. So Invicterix means like impenetrable fortress, which goes well with the type of dinosaur it was, and then Zephyri means, I think it's like of the Western winds. And it was homage to the brutal winds that were out there in this desert, as we were excavating this skeleton from the side of this mountain. So I really liked with what they ended up with.
That's so cool. That's so cool. And what a neat life experience to add to that, you know, and a good message for, you know, dreams come true. You got to go work with, find a dinosaur and work with infectious disease. So
absolutely,
that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, and definitely we want to thank you for joining us today. And personally, I know we didn't talk about this a whole lot, but I know that you've done a lot of work locally helping with COVID interventions and preventions, and you've done a lot for the communities here. And so I want to thank you for that as well. And then we wanted to give a moment here if there's anyone that you'd like to thank or recognize that's helped you along the way, besides the dinosaur, we'll give that credit too.
Yeah. Oh man. I mean, I owe a lot to my team at U of A, specifically Dr. Kathleen Walker and Dr. Casey Ernst. They've really helped mold me into both the epi and entomologist that I am today. Aside from that, my wife Sarita, she's been there and supported me during this business venture from the beginning, and she's no stranger to driving and setting surveillance traps for 10-hour days. So I can't thank her enough.
That's wonderful.
And of course, mostly my family, my aunt and uncle Nancy and Tim, they've always supported me in pretty much anything that I've put my mind to, and done everything they could to help me achieve those goals.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I'm so glad that you've had a good team there to support you, and an awesome wife for going out and setting traps for an hour day.
Yeah, she's fell in love with the My Favorite Murderer podcast, apparently.
Okay.
When you're driving 20, 24 hours a week, just nonstop, you have a lot of time to listen to audiobooks and podcasts, and I'll have to get her on this podcast.
Yeah, I was gonna say we'll have to spread her on, get her on to One Health Wednesdays.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, we wish you luck on your One Health adventure, and keep doing the good work that you're doing, and thank you again.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
To support the mission of One Health Wednesdays, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify and remember to leave a rating and review. You can find us on all social media channels and at onehealthwednesdays.com.